questions from ancient Greek science. This is not an area I've ever done much of anything in before last year, but was invited to take part in a conference up in Canada in August at Redeemer College, an evangelical college of Reformed sort, in connected with the Christian Reformed Church in Ontario. And they wanted some people with physics background to do a couple other different sessions called workshops called Beliefs in Physics. And if you were a workshop chair, which I was, you were supposed to kind of give a survey of the interaction of beliefs in physics. So I started reading around to that do, and it began to look like a 500-page book was probably going to be necessary if you started back at the earliest physicists and worked down to the present. So after I'd done about 300 years of period physics that we know very little about, I'd gotten enough material for the maximum length of the paper. So that's why this is some lessons from the ancient Greeks instead of from the modern English and Germans and such as well. Basically, what we plan to do here is give a brief sketch of the ancient Greek physics, starting at Thales about 600 BC and running down to Aristotle about 330. And we're going to suggest that this reveals a strong interaction between metaphysical belief on the one hand and the practice of physics on the other. This interaction worked in both directions, metaphysical views suggesting and inhibiting various questions and approaches to the physical realm, and physical observations and experiments favoring or disfavoring various metaphysical views. We're going to try to suggest some lessons then concerning how we should view modern physical theories in the light of this sort of history. Well, let's go. How do metaphysical beliefs and physics interact? To formulate some answers to this question, we need to look at actual examples. Here we consider some of the earliest information we have on mankind, seeking systematic understanding of our physical environment. Work of this sort may have been done in previous civilizations, but the first records we have come from the Greeks, beginning with Thales and Miletus shortly after 600 BC. We'll carry a survey down to Aristotle in the 4th century BC, the first to attempt a comprehensive physics. From our perspective, at the end of the 20th century, the physics of these early scientist philosophers seems crude, rash, and often absurd. Yet scientists only 200 years from now may well think the same of our physics. Let us then try to give each ancient thinker a sympathetic reading, seeking to understand what forces led to each proposal, how physical observation and research affected metaphysical views, and vice versa. There are some advantages to picking examples from so long ago, in spite of difficulties with historical sources. These early researchers first proposed a number of fundamental problems which have not been solved to this day. Yet we have advanced enough to see a good deal further along the road than they could. We can perhaps assess the fruit of their labors better than we can those of more recent physicists. First question we want to look at is the question of the physical substratum. How do we explain the nature of the material world which we observe? The question was apparently first answered in physical rather than supernatural terms by Thales of Miletus, a practical thinker, reputed to have made contributions to law, politics, civil engineering, mathematics, and astronomy. He's even credited with successfully predicting an eclipse of the sun in 585 BC, though most modern historians of science are inclined to take that with considerable grain of salt. Thales proposed that there was a single basic substance behind all the diverse phenomena we experience. His rather tangible choice for this substance was water. Thales not only thought water was the substance on which the earth actually floated, but also it was the basis of all other materials. Aristotle suggests he made this proposal because of the obvious necessity of moisture for life. A modern historian, Naum, thinks perhaps it was because Thales knew that water could assume the three forms, solid, liquid, and vapor. Thales' preference for natural causation, another historian, Farrington, suggests, came from observing various agricultural and industrial techniques. Thales felt free to advocate this openly because of the relative intellectual freedom in Miletus, a city ruled at that time by merchants rather than a military or priestly caste. Though preferring natural causes, Thales does not appear to have been an atheist. Aristotle says he thought that, quote, all things are full of gods. Perhaps he realized that technological processes depend on the natural attributes of the substances they manipulate. In terms here of metallurgy and and pottery and that sort of thing, clay working and that sort of thing. Perhaps he realized that technological processes depend on the natural attributes of substances they manipulate, and this led him to extend the idea of the processes operating in nature. The proposal has turned out to be rather fruitful. An Eximander followed Thales at Miletus, flourished about 555 BC. He was considered his student and successor. He also followed Thales' belief in a single natural universal substance, but rejected Thales' choice of water. Aristotle thinks that he did this because he could not see water as the source of fire, since their characteristics, water being cold and wet, and fire being hot and dry, were mutually destructive. Wet water makes dry fire not dry anymore. It puts out fire. Fire boils water, that sort of thing. An Eximander proposed an abstract substance, unlike anything observed, which he called a peron, meaning something like unlimited, boundless, or infinite. This basic substance, according to an Eximander, contained all the opposites and formed such secondary substances as fire and water by separation. These secondary substances had their origin in the apeiron and returned to it when they were destroyed. Anaximenes, flourished about 535 BC, was a third Milesian to investigate the basic constitution of matter. He too favored a single ultimate substance, but turned back to a material, an observable material air for his choice. Perhaps he felt his predecessor's apeiron was too far removed from observation. Anaximenes explained the diverse observed materials as various manifestations of air. When rarefied, he thought, air becomes fire. When it's condensed, it forms successively wind, and then more condensed cloud, more condensed water, and then earth, and then stone, as the degree of condensation increases. The cosmologies the Milesians proposed were based on their physics. Thales had his earth floating on water. An Eximander formed the cold earth and the fiery heavens by separation from the apeiron. An Eximenes floated his earth on air and employed the wind to push his stars around. Lloyd, a modern historian, says, the history of the Milesian views about the primary substance is chiefly remarkable for the way in which the awareness of the problems grew from one philosopher to the next. As is usual in the history of science, their actual theories strike a later age as childish. They already appeared to Aristotle. But to measure their achievement is the advance they made in grasping the problems. They rejected supernatural causation and appreciated that natural explanation can and should be given of a wide range of phenomena. And they took the first tentative steps toward an understanding of the problem of change. We move from physical substratum to a consideration of a mathematical substratum. A different approach to the question of what underlies the physical world was proposed by Pythagoras, or possibly by one of his followers who are named the Pythagoreans. Having observed that harmonious sounds are produced by vibrating strings whose lengths have simple ratios, he proposed that reality consists of numbers. The Pythagoreans apparently understood this in a rather crudely literal sense, that numbers are some kind of physical objects or something of that sort. But even though they did that, their suggestion led to an increasing interest in the form rather than the substance of matter. The suggestion also proved fruitful for research from antiquity onward, turning the attention of physicists and astronomers to numerical measurement and mathematical modeling. It led to substantial advances in knowledge among the Pythagorean astronomers. Unfortunately, it also produced a great deal of, quote, mumbo-jumbo and crude number mysticism, as Lloyd words the matter. And a fair amount of the things that you find in number mysticism of one sort or another have some starts out of the Pythagoreans. Plato, around 428 to 347, was influenced by the Pythagoreans and counted knowledge of geometry a necessity for admission to his academy. He observed that geometric drawings are at best only rough approximations to the ideas that lie behind them. For example, as you try and draw a circle, you know it's not a great circle, certainly it's freehand, and if you draw it very carefully, it's certainly not a perfect circle. The example which struck Plato especially was that a true tangent meets a circle at one point only, but it's impossible to draw this. nobody can draw that. Nobody can draw the line thin enough so that they only meet at one point. Plato apparently extrapolated this observation from geometry to reality in general, coming to the conclusion that ultimate reality consists of eternal, unchanging ideas, which are only imperfectly represented in the changing world of objects observable by our senses. True knowledge, then, according to Plato, is a knowledge of these eternal ideas rather than of unreliable sensory data. The results are described by Claggett, another recent historian. He says, we do not have to wait until medieval or early modern times for the application of geometry to the investigation of nature, for it began in both physics and astronomy in the 4th century B.C. and matured in the Hellenistic and Greco-Roman periods. We've already suggested the basic importance of the Pythagorean mathematical point of view, but when that mathematical point of view was coupled with something close to scorn of the world of senses, as it was in some of the Platonic dialogues, little sound physics could arise. Even the most apologetic Platonist will not stand behind Plato's work Timaeus as a work of high scientific caliber, although it is true that some of the ideas suggested therein were not without their influence on Aristotle and later authors. So, the question of the mathematical substrate. We turn to consider the problem of motion and vacuum. Meanwhile, the question of how motion could be reconciled with the idea of a single universal substance was being considered by Parmenides. Notice the men we've talked about so far have thought in terms of a single universal substance: Thales, water, and Eximander, Peyron and Eximenes, air, the Pythagoreans, number, and Plato, ideas. Meanwhile, the question of how motion could be reconciled with the idea of a single universal substance was being considered by Parmenides, who flourished about 480. He came to the rather startling conclusion that it couldn't. Parmenides believed the single universal substance to be being itself. A vacuum was thus non-being, which by definition could not exist. Therefore, all space was filled with the single ultimate substance, which could not change without being non-ultimate, and had no room to move. Rather than accepting the testimony of human senses as indicating that something must be wrong with this argument, Parmenides chose instead to believe that our senses are in error. Parmenides' follower Zeno constructed several exceedingly clever arguments to prove that motion did not exist. The most famous one is the one, I believe it's Achilles and the tortoise. Get confused here a little bit. But the idea basically is there's going to be a foot race between this very slow turtle and this very fast runner, Achilles. But Achilles good-naturedly gives the turtle a head start. Achilles can run, we'll say, 10 times as fast as the turtle. That's actually there. Most people can run quite more than 10 times as fast as the turtle. But use that for figure for general idea. So suppose Achilles gives the turtle a 10-foot head start. Then when Achilles starts, the turtle is 10 foot ahead of him. And when Achilles has run 10 feet, the turtle is now on another foot, the turtle is a foot ahead of him. And when Achilles goes that foot, the turtle is a tenth of a foot ahead of him. And when Achilles goes a tenth of a foot, the turtle is 100 foot ahead of him. And Zeno basically argued that both the series was an infinite series, and therefore Achilles would never catch up with the turtle. Therefore, motion was illusory and didn't really occur. These arguments were frequently ignored, but not successfully refuted until the invention of calculus some 2,000 years later. The refutation, which I don't mention in my paper, is basically, yes, there's an infinite series of these things, but if you measure the length of time for Achilles to travel each of those, that is an infinite series also, and each of the series has each step smaller and smaller in such a way that it's got a finite sum. It's easier for me to explain a finite sum from an infinite series by using the half series rather than the tenth series. But basically, if you start walking and you take your first step as a foot-long step, and your next step as a half-foot step, and your next step as a quarter-foot step, and your next step as a 8-foot step, that is, each step is half as long as the next, you will never reach 2 feet. That is, the infinite series of 1 plus 1/2 plus 1/4 plus 1/8 plus 1/16, etc., is 2. Now, if you take a second for each of those steps, it will take forever to get to 2, obviously. However, if you're walking at a constant rate and you just choose to divide things up that way, you're walking at a constant rate of a foot per second, you will get to the 2 foot mark in 2 seconds, even though you can imagine dividing the thing up into things. And that's basically the answer to that particular problem, that Achilles will catch up with the turtle at 11.11111111 feet, and if he's running at 10 feet per second, it will take him 1.11111111 seconds to catch up with him. So you can work that out if you like sometime. Zeno's arguments, though exceedingly clever and frequently ignored, were successfully refuted with the invention of calculus about 2,000 years later. One solution to the quandary posed by Parmenides was to adopt a pluralistic worldview rather than his monistic one. That is, that there are several basic substances rather than one. Basically, what Parmenides had got people hung up with was there was only one substance, and vacuum couldn't exist because he defined it as non-being, and therefore there was nowhere for the substance to move. But one solution is to say, well, there are a number of ultimate substances, and they can slip beside one another, and so one of them can move through another in some way, and the other kind of pushes the other out of the way. And so in this case, motion could take place as the different substances slipped by or mixed with one another, even if there was no vacuum to provide extra room to move about in. Empedocles, about 445, adopted this approach, proposing that there were four elements instead of only one, namely earth, water, air, and fire. This becomes kind of the traditional division of substances in antiquity, largely due to Aristotle picking up the same thing. All material things, then, were a mixture of these, and change took place within some physical thing when the composition of various mixtures changed. The cause of such changes, Empedocles took to be two forces, which he called love and strife, and which we would call attraction and repulsion. This model, as developed further by Plato and Aristotle, was to be the dominant view in physics through the rest of antiquity until modern times. Anaxagoras, flourished about the same time, carried this pluralistic idea to an extreme by postulating the existence of an infinite number of different sorts of things, seeds or germs, he called them, which were infinitely small and eternal. Every existing thing is a mixture of these, so that when a human eats fruit, say, the body does not make flesh and bone out of some other substance, but it extracts the flesh and bone particles from the food. Anaxagoras' influence does not appear to have been great. He was going against a preferred tendency to explain the diversity of phenomena by as few items as possible. Occam's razor, thus, was already in use long before Occam was born, a tendency to minimize the explanatory causes. The response to Parmenides which most neatly solved the problem he raised was the atomic theory, proposed by Leucippus about 435, developed by Democritus a generation later, and still further by Epicurus about a century after that. Reality, said the atomists, consists of an eternally existing universal substance, but this occurs as an infinite number of unchangeable and visibly small particles, called atoms, Greek indivisible, because they could not be cut into smaller pieces. The atoms, however, were separated from one another by a void or vacuum, so that motion was possible and, in fact, continual. So basically, the atomists rejected the idea that vacuum equals non-being, but rather vacuum is non-substance in some way. There are gaps between the substance particles. Unlike Anaxagoras' seeds, atoms were all of the same substance, but differed in size and shape. They formed the various objects of our experience by collision and entanglement, the origin of a particular material occurring when the atoms came together, its destruction when the atoms separated. Thus, change was real and didn't need to be explained away as an illusion. On the other hand, sensory characteristics themselves were due to the shapes and combinations of the atoms, not to real colors and tastes in the atoms. Democritus, in particular, speculated elaborately on the nature of sensory experience and on how such characteristics as hardness and softness, lightness and heaviness were produced in various objects. Surprisingly, Democritus, too, felt rational thought was more reliable than observation. The ancient atomic theory never achieved dominance in antiquity like the modern atomic theory has. It ascribed the origin of the world to chance rather than intelligence, and it had nothing beyond necessity to explain large-scale organization within the world. Physics of Aristotle. By the time of Aristotle, 382 to 322, Greek astronomy had progressed to the point that astronomical objects were obviously much larger and further away than meteorological phenomena. Heraclides of Pontus, around the time of right at the end of Aristotle's life, by 330, proposed that the daily motion of the sun, moon, and stars was actually due to the Earth's rotation, but this apparently came too late to influence Aristotle, and it didn't meet with acceptance, widespread acceptance in any case. Without telescopes, changes in the sky were not obvious beyond the moon, so it's not surprising that Aristotle proposed a two-realm version of physics. Above the moon was a supralunar realm without any change, and where all motion was eternal and circular, following a scheme developed earlier by Eudoxus about 365. Below the moon was the sublunar realm of change, characterized by natural vertical motion as each of the four elements sought its own level. Earth at the bottom, water above that, air above that, fire above that. Aristotle modified the four-element scheme of Empedocles, however, by allowing the elements to be transformed from one to another. So instead of the elements being fixed and could not change and they mixed in various ways, he had some thought of some way in which Earth could change to water or that sort of thing. Aristotle modified the four-element scheme of Empedocles by allowing the elements to be transformed from one into another and by adding a fifth element, ether, from which the superlunar realm was constructed. I don't know the history of how ether became the stuff that doctors eventually gave for putting people to sleep, but it is the same ether that was being talked about late in the last century on the question of whether one could measure the motion of the Earth passing through the ether. So the idea was around from Aristotle until the late 19th century. Aristotle also proposed four kinds of causation, and here he basically picks up three elements that had been among the philosophers so far, and adds another which certainly had been thought about, but didn't characterize any of the philosophical groups. Aristotle proposed four kinds of causation. One, a material cause, like that of the Milesians, what something was made of. Secondly, a formal cause, like that of the Pythagoreans and Plato, how something was structured. Third, an efficient cause, like that of Empedocles, what forces produced it, and four, a final cause, for what purpose the object was made. If we think about a table, for instance, Aristotle would say the material cause is, let's say, wood, if we think of a wood table rather than this warm white metal table I'm sitting here by, wood, and the formal cause would be the plan in the woodworker's mind, the craftsman's mind, of how he was going to structure that table. So if it's a round table with a certain type of pedestal legs on it, that would be the formal cause of it, if you like. The efficient cause would presumably be the effort which the craftsman would put forth in cutting and planing and perhaps gluing and that sort of thing. And the final cause would be, could be split in various ways, the craftsman desiring to make a work of beauty, desiring to make something for him to eat his meals at, or desiring to sell it to someone else so he'd have some money to buy some food to eat some meals. Those would be final causes, purpose in the mind of the maker. Aristotle's physics and Aristotle's causation continued to have influence through antiquity and the medieval period until modern times, as they appeared to provide both consistency and believable explanations for the observed natural order. That's our tour from Thales to Aristotle. Now, basically, we want to think a little bit about interactions during this period between metaphysics and physics. We must now consider what we've learned about how metaphysical beliefs and physics interact. So the first question we address is, how are physical concepts used to develop and evaluate metaphysical beliefs? Suggest, first of all, that the techniques of craftsmen, perhaps jewelry workers, metal workers, weavers, potters, that sort of thing, may have suggested naturalistic explanations for physical phenomena to Thales and his followers. So physical concepts used to develop the idea that natural causation might lie behind what we would call physics. The discovery that harmonious sounds were produced when vibrating strings had lengths and simple ratios may have led the Pythagoreans to postulate the idea that number is the ultimate feature of reality rather than matter. The realization that geometric drawings are at best only rough approximations of the ideas that lie behind them apparently convinced Plato that ultimate reality consisted of eternal ideas, which are only imperfectly realized in physical things. Reluctance to abandon sensory experience kept many from following Parmenides' denial that motion was anything other than an illusion, proposing instead various models of reality in which change and motion were real. These included the multi-element schemes of Empedocles and Anaxagoras, and the atomist's introduction of a void and breaking the ultimate substance into tiny pieces. Astronomical evidence that heavenly bodies were at great distances was in part responsible, together with Eudoxus' scheme for reducing the heavenly motions to circles, for Aristotle's distinction between the earthly realm of change and the changeless heavens. So some examples of how physical observations, physical concepts, etc., were used either to develop or to evaluate metaphysical views. How were metaphysical beliefs used to develop and evaluate physical concepts and theories? The Milesians' metaphysic of natural causation led to their suggesting various natural explanations for everyday phenomena, which Greek mythology had described as Zeus, Poseidon, or one of the other gods. It also led to speculation regarding a most basic substance. This resulted, on the one hand, in beginning attempts to study the basis of matter. On the other, it consistently produced unwarranted optimism that the nature of the substratum would be easily discerned. The Pythagorean metaphysic of number as the basis of nature proved very fruitful in some fields, and certainly was important in introducing mathematics as a tool to understanding reality. However, it also led to considerable number speculation, where the subject of investigation was not hospitable to such an approach, at least at that time. Plato's view that reality was an eternal idea rather than their imperfect representation in nature led him to devalue the use of observation and experiment on physical objects in favor of purely rational, purely abstract reasoning, and this tended to disconnect theory from observation. Parmenides' view that motion was logically impossible led him to reject the contrary testimony of the senses. Democritus' view that reality could be completely described by atoms moving in the void led him to a number of striking insights mixed with numerous unwarranted speculations. His strongly reductionistic explanations ignored the possibility of higher levels of structure and of design in nature. The apparent completeness and consistency of Aristotle's division of the cosmos into two realms with two types of physics had long-term and largely negative effects on the practice of physics, which were not overcome until the late Middle Ages. So he had the explanations of why an arrow does what it does, which after people began to observe more carefully, they found an arrow doesn't do what Aristotle thought it did, and began to rethink that. And that was already being rethought in the late Middle Ages, before we get to what is often considered the Renaissance. By the time of Plato and Aristotle, widening class divisions in the Greek city-states were discouraging the leisured class from involvement in hands-on technical sorts of labor. This seems to have had a negative effect on any research which looked practical, leading to the devaluation of the sort of physical investigations which would later transform Western society in the centuries after the Reformation. So we tour some influences of metaphysical ideas on the physics agenda, if you like. Thirdly, how do shared metaphysical beliefs of the physics or science community influence its research agenda? There were apparently no really organized physics or science communities at the beginning of this era, but certainly the Milesians sought purely natural explanations of phenomena. Though this encouraged experimentation and observation, it made it difficult for them to explain the occurrence of order in nature. The Pythagoreans were certainly a community, though more of a religious fellowship than a scientific society. They concentrated on applying mathematics to their investigations, producing some impressive results where this was possible at the time, astronomy, acoustics, etc., but rather fantastic number mysticism elsewhere. The Academy of Plato was mainly successful from our perspective here. In its mathematical work, as the emphasis on reason rather than observation tended to produce abstract logical constructions. Plato's proposal that the movement of astronomical objects be explained by combination of circular motions both helped and hindered astronomical research. Plato's admission of eternal forms gave better explanations for order in nature than the merely natural material causation of the Milesians and the Atomists. Aristotle's proposal of four types of causation, matter, structure, energy, and purpose, made better sense of the observed order of nature. Together with a restoration of the value of observation, this led to some effective biological research in his school of the Lyceum at his time and later. Some lessons for today. Can such a brief tour of ancient Greek physics teach us anything about how we should view physics today? I believe it can. Consider the following questions in the light of our survey. Suppose we go with a hierarchical structure of reality, that there are levels of nature which we can then penetrate behind, or go above or go below, depending on how we're thinking of it, trying to find what is more and more basic, if you like. Given a hierarchical structure to reality, is there any reason to believe that an empirically constructed bottom-up metaphysics, starting at observations and trying to work behind them and up in this analogy, will be anything more than accidentally correct before the final physics is discovered? Well, ancient Greek science, though showing real progress, does not seem promising for this hope. Thales and Anaximenes' proposal that water and air are the ultimate substances seem especially crude to us, but they were based on certain observations. Anaximander's more sophisticated idea of an unspecified stuff behind appearances is an improvement, and it sought to solve the problem of contrary attributes. Anaximenes' concept of condensation and rarefaction, presumably based on the conversion of water into ice and steam, also marked a step forward. Aristotle's version of Empedocles' four-element theory, earth, water, air, fire, though returning to visible material as basic, at least provided for one element to change into another. In retrospect, none of these suggestions were close to what we know to be the case today. We haven't got there yet, but we're pretty well satisfied we know what water is, and it isn't the basic substance. And we know what air is, and it isn't the basic substance. It's hard to argue with Apeiron, I suppose, but even the ancient atomic theories, though a vast improvement with their invisible units of structure and space between them, were unable to explain macroscopic attributes except by arbitrary guesswork. Throughout the period, we see increasing sophistication, coupled with the incorporation of additional evidence, which eventually was revived in modern times as a new atomic theory. But modern investigation has found that what we call atoms are composites of nucleons and electrons, and that nucleons are probably composites of quarks. There's no way yet for us to tell if quarks, too, may not be composite. We don't know how deep the hierarchy is, nor whether anything lies beneath it. So we move some distance, but there's no guarantee that at one particular level you kind of finally got it. And each time we found another level, it's different at that next level. How does Occam's razor influence physics? Do we tend to jump to unwarranted conclusions about the completeness of very preliminary theories? Though Occam's razor is a medieval term, it describes a common human tendency to construct the simplest theory consistent with the known evidence. Clearly, it is valuable as a method of procedure, but the ancient Greeks had no idea how complicated nature might be and tended to think they were only one layer away from the bottom. We can see they were mistaken, having penetrated several more layers, but what about our theories? Are we only a layer away from the bottom of things, or do we also jump to conclusions when we ascribe to them an ultimacy they may not deserve? In the area of kinematics, question of motion, is it reasonable to believe that nature can be limited to three spatial dimensions and one time dimension, as characterized as modern relativity theory? This is certainly the simplest model, consistent with our current empirical bottom-up physics. But mathematics has been worked out for larger dimensionalities. Some of the recent grand unification theories incorporate 11 or more dimensions. And certain features of the occult and of the supernatural in scripture point to a more complex situation. One's worldview will have an influence on whether this is thought to be possible or probable, and whether it might be worth pursuing as a research strategy. obviously there you're going to get an influence of your metaphysics on whether you're willing to investigate or consider as possible that we might live in a dimension, a universal higher dimensionality, or whether a scripture or a cult phenomena should have any bearing on that particular question, should be treated as evidence. Moving to the area of dynamics, how motions take place rather than just sort of describing motions without thinking about causation. In the area of dynamics, is it reasonable to believe that the four currently known forces are all that exist, that they may be unified into a single superforce? Currently, it is believed that that there are four forces in the universe, and they're called typically, working down from top, the strong nuclear force, electromagnetic force, the weak, I'm sure we'll call it nuclear force that way, and gravity down much, much weaker than these. It's certainly reasonable to believe these things in the sense that we know no reason why they may not be true, why there may not be, why there might be only four of them, and why they might be unifiable. The activity of the last 30 years or so, at least, has been trying to unify these forces, even further back than that. The successes so far is that Maxwell in the last century unified magnetism and electricity. And so we now talk of the electromagnetic force. And then just in the last 20 years, I'll forget all the guys' names. Solomon is the only one I can think of at the moment. Weinberg, and who's the other guy? Yeah, gotcha. Devised a way of unifying the weak force and electromagnetic force. So with those two things having occurred, there's kind of a hope that maybe you can figure out how to align the strong force with that, and then finally align gravity with that, and explain everything as a single superforce. It's certainly reasonable to believe these things in the sense that we know of no reason why they might not be true. The discussion above, however, should cause us to be wary of too much confidence here, since two of these forces, the strong and weak interactions, were only discovered in this century, and we have generally been poor prophets of what advancing technology will turn up. The desire for unification and simplification has often been fruitful in research, but like Pythagoreanism, has equally often led astray. In the area of dynamics, is it reasonable to believe that knowing the ultimate particles and physical forces will be sufficient to explain reality without recourse to special initial or boundary conditions? The question here is it enough to know the forces and the particles, or do you have to know where they all started and what they were doing in order to explain what's going on and such? Without making use of special revelation, we do not know the answer to this question. However, the fine-tuning in our universe, currently being discussed as the anthropic principle, suggests that planning, rather than chance, is the more basic characteristic of reality. In the area of dynamics, is it reasonable to believe that the universe is an automaton like a clock that runs by itself, whether it happened accidentally or was designed, or may it be an instrument like a guitar that is designed for input? Again, input from special revelation is helpful here, though it is currently viewed as, quote, more scientific, unquote, to opt for a self-contained closed universe. After some 2,500 years of doing physics from inside our universe, we still don't know whether there's an ultimate substratum, and so what it looks like. We have progressed enough to be sure it's not water, air, or atoms in either the ancient or modern sense of those words. There is a strange resonance in reality between mathematics and the human mind and the structure of nature. We don't know enough to say how pervasive this structure is or how it is composed. Parmenides and Zeno were certainly mistaken about the unreality of motion. If it finally turns out they were right about our senses being totally deceived, it will have only been a lucky guess. The human sensory apparatus and its technological extensions, microscopes, telescopes, etc., have revealed an orderly world of much greater complexity than any of the ancients imagined. The reductionism of Democritus is still with us in a suitably updated form, but it faces some real challenges from design and nature. Aristotle was wrong about there being two different kinds of physics for the terrestrial and astronomical realm. It might yet prove that he was right for the earthly realm and the heavenly realm. We'll have to wait and see how that works out. Okay, that's the talk. I'll be glad to try and field any questions. I don't expect too much. So, question. Yeah.
Yeah. in your first page, you say, well, our physics in 200 years were basically as absurd as some of the things that we find from antiquity. There are some, there is some physics that's 200 years old. I think of Newton, I think of Kepler. And we still feel that that is really quite accurate in the realm in which it is applied. And I'm just wondering if that isn't because of the great wedding now of mathematics and physical theory and experiment and prediction and technology. And therefore, the idea that our physical theories will be ridiculous is mitigated against, although we may find other theories that complement them. Many people feel that special relativity did away with Newton. It didn't. It basically refined it. And so I'm wondering if perhaps the future isn't going to be one more refinement rather than one of overthrow.
I think it's fair to say that we have looked at most of the phenomena that can be looked at with the present equipment, or at least equipment we've had around for 50 years, let's say. And so it'd be surprising, at least, if there are any surprises. That's kind of a tautology, you can tell. So I think it's probably fair to say that the form in which surprises come in the future in physics would probably be penetrating further down and seeing that there were more levels than we thought there were, and therefore some complications in that direction. It would certainly be very surprising if somebody showed that somehow some observations in the past that we had thought were okay turned out to be drastically wrong. I suppose there are always possibilities of somebody deciding that certain constants that we thought were fixed are in fact changing and discovering some evidence of that. In young Earth circles, there's been a lot of this talk about changing the speed of light, and in secular circles there had been some talk, and is even yet a little talk perhaps on changing constant gravitation or changing the size of the gravitational interaction or something, although at the moment that has been simply shot rather badly. So I don't expect an overthrow in the sense of the Copernican sort of thing, whereas the mechanisms were totally thrown out, although even there they were based on observation and the observation still had to be fit. That would be pretty surprising.
Do you think the Heisenberg uncertainty principle also will allow something to go so low? In other words, we will reach the ground level, we basically reach the ground level, and we get to the point where Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is operative. And then we just talk about probabilities and chances.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if in fact we haven't reached a ground level of some sort, at least in that area of physics.
Yeah. To me, it feels like we have reached a floor rather like as on many bridges with sort of this grating that stuff, air is coming up through the grating, but you can't get down any further. That kind of is the analogy I have at the moment, is that we've gotten down to the place where we can still build bigger and bigger particle accelerators, and they can therefore penetrate to smaller size scales, but you're certainly doing disruptive things down there, and you wonder whether you're going to get any information about how things work intact down below that level. Difficult to know what to say about that. You definitely do have some kind of a epistemological barrier that is operating. And whether that was designed in to keep the angels from being found on the other side who are shooting the phenomena through or something, I don't know. What can you say? We have not yet reached any epistemological barrier as far as we can tell on the large scale, cosmologically. Although, obviously, in principle, you could reach a horizon of some sort in which the objects are moving away from you faster than the speed of light beyond that, and that's where it quits. Or you could, and we already think that we're seeing stuff from one horizon, namely the black body radiation is coming from the horizon at which the universe cleared, and that before that it's opaque, and you can no more see back earlier than that directly than you can see through an opaque thing. Just as we can't visibly see any deeper into the sun than its surface. Now, we've got tricks to try and get around that, at different wavelengths, or we think the neutrinos coming out of the sun are giving us information further down, and maybe you can get around it that way on the cosmological scale.
But even there, you get to the quantum, which again deals with basically with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and that's as far as...
Yeah, yeah. And there you're getting some fairly wild statements by some people, like time doesn't mean anything beyond this, so we don't need to worry about what's behind there. That seems to be the big bailing out, if you like. But that's good. Yeah.
If I can say one thing, and not to monopolize here, but you wonder then how much human activity comes into this as well. Do we have valid systems now for determining what reality is like, with human beings what they are, the suppression that takes place, ignoring some of this, and perhaps it's not really the technology or the mathematics or the experiment that is keeping science from advancing. It's what we basically are as human beings and our own prejudice that we don't understand. And if that's the case, then you don't know which way things are going to go.
Yeah. The Ptolemaic astronomical system, which I just mentioned, he mentioned Ptolemy at all, mentioned Doxus at one point. The idea that all the stars and planets and everything up there are doing circles around us in the sky is not a bad observation from down here. It's just that the Earth is a circling instead of the sky is circling. And then they kept improving the fit with observations by having circles within circles and things of that sort. And until they could, in some sense, get through that barrier, and the barrier there was probably technological, partly, building telescopes to see that, yes, there was change on the sun, there were sunspots. Yes, the moon looked like an Earth that had mountains and apparently seas and that sort of thing. So you had kind of a technological barrier, but also some kind of a gestalt barrier or a worldview barrier or something. Once they got through that, they could do some more, but as long as they were on one side of that, it wasn't obvious that there was anything wrong with Ptolemy's scheme. I suppose you could have the same thing now. You'd say, we've reached this quantum barrier, and it's not obvious up here that there's anything wrong with the Copenhagen interpretation, that everything is really chance. There's no design below. Yet it seems to me, as Perry suggested, we've got some information from behind the barrier. Revelation. And the revelation tells us that, no, it's not all finally chance down there. I'm inclined to think that evidence of design in nature also tells us it's not all chance down there. But you've certainly got people around who are ready to say, you know, well, you just have random things going on and somehow design arises out of it, etc. What can you say about that? We don't know anything directly about the guys before Socrates. Thales, Anaximander, Anaximenes, etc. We have got sketchy reports from several centuries later. Aristotle says something about them. His successor, Theophrastus, says something about them. The early Christian author, Hippolytus, says something about them. So there was more information around about them in antiquity than there is now, but we don't have any of the writings. They're not that far apart, yeah. The Milesians were all over in Miletus, which is in, I don't have any maps here, is not far from Ephesus in Asia Minor. And the other guys are, most of them, over in Greece proper, and they are a couple hundred years apart. They certainly knew something about what the others had done, because there's some comments back and forth about it. But how they knew, how much written material survived, there seemed to be enough agreement on what they believe that some information came down somewhere.
I'm curious that, you know, for those couple hundred years, I mean, I had some people that I go back before the table, and I even in direct information, there's not too much information about the type of rock.
Yeah. Part of the complication is that surely there are metallurgists in many of the cultures in antiquity. We got their products. We have not people written by them. There are probably two or three reasons for that. One, they weren't in the upper class. They might not know how to write. Or two, they were trying to keep stuff secret. There weren't any patent laws. And so if you blab how it's done, everybody else gets into stuff. So I don't know. Part of it's trade secrets. Part of it is we've got rather little of that kind of writing that survives. You have kind of the upper class literature, and then you have a lot of mercantile trade information, that sort of stuff. Yeah, that's the physics. Okay, it's not fair to say that science stagnated from Aristotle onward. He did some biology, some guys after him did, there was a lot more astronomy done in Alexandria and such after this time. But there wasn't a whole lot more physics done in the sort of broad overarching scheme. There was, in fact, some guys who did some work with hydraulics and with vacuums. And one guy showed that, yes, there must be something like a vacuum because he could compress and decompress air. And so there must be spaces between it in some way that you're increasing or decreasing. So some work of that sort was done. The work seems to have moved out of what we think of as Greece proper into some of the other Hellenistic city-states after Alexander's time. Alexandria itself became, of course, a big center of this sort of work. You've got a scattered field. But one of the things that that I mentioned in the last kind of paragraph there under, I think it was before I began trying to work on all these questions. No, it wasn't. It was how did metaphysical beliefs influence physical things? This widening class divisions, which led to the people who had the time and money to do research not wanting to dirty their hands with research. You got kind of a split between technology and theory, if you like. And that really does not get healed again until modern period. And I think an influence of Christianity and perhaps Protestantism that kind of brings that back together again. There are some individual examples where that's not a huge problem. But that does seem to be a problem. People just it grew up in a culture where it was beneath them to do manual labor.
Why die, and also, you know, someone's beginning to kind of outlandish, like the idea that emotional, you know, where are we going with this? You know, that seems kind of But I would think that if there was some kind of scale for this, that that the magnitude would still be great, even with the
well, this
why,
is
go why in the Lord's revelation is he so sparing in the pointed revelations?
Yeah. Well, I raised a lot of things. The question on Adam, my own guess is that he was not vastly more knowledgeable about how the universe worked than we are. He obviously was vastly more knowledgeable of God than anybody since then, because he had personal acquaintance in some way. But probably it's fair to say that the fall began to mess up things, that if they had not fallen, my guess would be science and technology would have developed very rapidly, just as it has developed fairly rapidly just in the last few centuries. And so, you know, we might be populating other galaxies by this time if man had not turned aside. So I think you got that. In other words, sin tends to mess things up, and it has messed up things up here as well. And you've had some striking spurts of science for short periods of time, but typically what has happened is that in the course of time, man's sinfulness in one way or another has really finally fouled them up, and they've stagnated or even got lost, depending on how bad the collapse is. And it's probably not unfair to say that if we continue long enough in the direction we are now, it may be that science would come to a halt again, that perhaps a interest in New Age type phenomena might move so many people away from doing any science that it would collapse or something like that. So, obviously, civilizations currently depend on science and technology strongly enough that there's very strong economic incentives. So it might take a dark ages or something to produce something. That's hard to judge. But it's interesting that science kind of dies out in antiquity. Then it's revived briefly in the Islamic period, and it dies out again. And it kind of gets snuffed out again. It's probably a closer representation to the matter that some of the strictures of Islamic orthodoxy came into play in such a way that they stopped allowing accounts to investigate. So you're really getting some strong influences of your worldview on doing your science, if you like. Today, you've now gotten the definition in the scientific community of science as not allowing any supernatural causes. And if it turns out, as I think it does, that a good handful of the questions we're investigating involve rather explicitly supernatural intervention of some sort, they're not going to make any progress in those things. The kind of progress they make will be basically imaginary in some sense. So you may get that sort of thing. So. Further comments, Scott? Yeah. Difference because they had several kinds of clocks, not mechanical wind-up clocks, as far as we know. Well, no. They had water clock and they had a sand clock, a hourglass, we would call it. So they had clocks around. I'm pretty sure both of those would go back as far as Parmenides easily. Of course, they had sundials, etc. As well. But at least in the sand clock and the water clock, you kind of know what's happening, whereas in the other one, you're not sure who's moving. Etc. So, no, really what you get with Parmenides and Zeno and those guys is they admit that it looks like things are moving, but they are sufficiently convinced of the strength of their argumentation that they feel the appearance of motion must be illusory. So what you really got is you're getting a conflict, rather interesting sort of conflict, if you like, between mathematics and physics, if you like, or between theory and observation. And these guys were sufficiently satisfied with the rigor of their theory that they were ready to overthrow the observation. Looking back on it, we can see that, although there was certain rigor there in their thing, and some of the geometry and some of the argumentation, very impressive among the Greeks in the geometric area, that they really had overlooked a couple of things that turned out to be crucial in that particular one. Was machinery in antiquity. We tend to think of it as a non-machine period, but warfare used some fairly impressive mechanical equipment. not just the battering ram, but devices for throwing stones and for shooting big arrows long distances. There was a device for raising water. Who made that? Archimedes? Yeah, that's probably after the earliest guys here, but that's it's Archimedes. Is he? Here's my problem. Okay, it's Syracuse. So later, another couple centuries later than Aristotle. There was certainly some machinery around. It's usually been argued the other way around, that if it weren't for this split between technology and theorizing, if that split hadn't occurred, then it might have been Greeks who had developed a technological civilization. But they're having abandoned that. They basically tinkered around with minor things. They didn't see any need to build labor-saving devices because they had all the cheap labor they wanted, they had slaves. So that sort of thing comes on later after slavery is gone, and after Christianity has arisen with a worldview in which manual labor is not a terrible thing. There's some sense in which manual labor is made painful because of the fall, but Adam was involved in manual labor before the fall. So that seems to be the more important problem in some way. They were doing some things in optics. They were certainly doing some things in mechanics. They had done a little with steam. Heroes, a lawn sprinkler that was powered by steam instead of by water, but then never went anywhere to try and develop that so it worked to do real work, I guess. There's water wheels were being used by the Romans, certainly. Some rather impressive stuff in that direction. Concrete, etc. I don't know that they ever solved the copying technology. Printing, the Chinese had something like printing, but what was movable copy. Arquicus, in his Christian Rise of Science, suggests that a certain feature of the Christian worldview is rather crucial in getting science started again. After he died out in the ancient world, there's some arguments over what all the factors were in the ancient world, what probably just this science technology split, and then what killed it in the Islamic world. There's some religious things at work. A belief that nature wasn't really particularly great. Plato basically thought you really couldn't get very reliable information from experiment. And he had an analogy that's a good analogy. You can't draw, even on paper with careful equipment, perfect circles, and you will miss some things in geometric work if you try to do everything by observation instead of trying to work out proofs and stuff. He's right about that. All that basically means is that, nature doesn't, at least on our level of observation, doesn't exactly conform to mathematical logical ideas. And how that was solved after the Renaissance was largely trying to abstract certain things from nature and trying to see if after making certain simplifications they would satisfactorily do it and then try and put back the things. Galileo's idea one should try and remove the influence of friction more and more and see if we could get some guesses then on how things behave without it. But that was a very clever suggestion, which turned out to work out well. Bart.
Mm-hmm.
There The rise of professional science is really quite recent. As late as early in the last century, even in places like England, which would have considered themselves considerably more advanced than the U.S., there are very few professional scientists. So what you've had happen since about that time is that governments have realized more and more that there are lots of advantages to support science. And so you've gotten more and more government tax support for science, which before that had largely been funded by people who were interested in themselves. They were almost hobbyists, or they were teachers at a university of some sort. But even there, the university didn't have a lot of money for them. And if you look at our society, I'm sure the thing was similar in Russia, it was really the government that was putting up most of the money to run science. And the areas they weren't putting up for weren't doing much. That also is a challenge to Christians today in regard to the whole scientific area. We cannot expect that the Christian church is going to put up a big fraction of their income to fund science. The Creation Research Society, which is considerably better funded in many ways, say the Gipper is, has only just now, after what, 20 years or so, gotten a gift from apparently a well-to-do couple that's going to allow them to have a little research center out in the desert area somewhere in the southwest. In other words, the Grand Canyon area. So apparently they got enough money, or maybe even got somebody's vacation home or something of that sort. And I suppose some money put aside that will accrue interest to fund some stuff. But it's not a big grant. To have grants and such, you've either got to have a king of some sort interested in these things. We go back to an earlier society. And some of them were. The library at Alexandria and that very sort of things were some of the output of the Ptolemies money. Dynasty that ruled there for a number of centuries. So some of the same sort of thing in the Renaissance period that various little kinglets and such put up money, some Venetian princes or some German kings or that sort of thing. Now, you're obviously going to have a much different level of science in some sense if you've got amateurs. How many amateurs have got money to build a synchrotron or something like that. So, my impression is we don't have too much information from them. We got a lot of information from Plato, so you get a pretty good idea. Classicist, however, you get a pretty good idea how he thought about those things and worked those things together. I don't get that impression. That those particular guys went that far. You obviously do get some of your guys. I think the cynics and the such that were very skeptical about the skeptics, I guess, actually would be the technical term, that really thought you couldn't know anything. And one of them claimed that he didn't care about being run over by wagons, etc. Somebody pointed out he was inconsistent because he got afraid and ran when a dog barked at him. I think, as Francis Schaeffer points out, for a modern phenomenon, that it is very hard to live by some of these philosophies. Yes. They and the Hindus would be two of your big groups today that claim that, you're sort of more technical Hinduism. This is all illusion. But they've got a commitment to the elusiveness of it.
Right.
And that can mean, perhaps, that they will use Christian Science methods of healing when they ought to be using some x-ray treatment to get a cancer zapped or something of that sort. So you get that kind of effect. I think you can see a big difference between a society that believes that reality is, experiential observation and such is basically reliable, the West, and it's unreliable, say the East, India, and it really shows up in their technology and some of those sorts of things. Well, in other words, you really do have some feedback there between what your worldview is and what produces in the particular lifestyle. What those feedbacks will be in detail will vary somewhat.
Do you suggest anything about how you live in the Lord's sense of priority as far as our minds are?
Well, I think I'd put it this way, that one of the commands which God gave Adam was to go out, subdue the earth, etc. And I would think, along with sort of your reform guys that talk about cultural mandate, that God has given us a responsibility to understand his world as well as we can and to do things with his world. Interestingly, it appears God has made a world which is designed to be technologically improved. That's the way I would characterize it. Designed. Because the saints and prophets are all involved in redemptive activity, and the thing that has really gotten messed up is man's relationship to God rather than man's ability to make swords or something of that sort. And yet it's rather interesting that the end of the age, the new heavens and new earth, you're in city, buildings and streets and that sort of thing. It seems to me, in other words, you see a definite technological advance between how things are in the garden and how things are in the eternal state. And yes, and I don't know. We don't know what the redeemed are doing right now in heaven, whether they're helping Jesus prepare a place for it or not. I personally think that we have a tendency to pick up kind of Platonic sort of idea of spirit is non-material and material is bad, and that is not the Bible's picture. The Bible's picture is man was made, body and soul. Man will be back in a body for the rest of eternity.
Hanging around with a few people in Galilee. And we think that, you know, the magnitude of all he's created, and that is the involvement of the church, you know, and that's good.
Yeah, I do too.
But it's still, you know, it's something.
Yeah, I think you're right that it's clear the Bible doesn't make the main point technology, or even the main point finding out physically what the universe is like, although certainly it says a fair bit about our responsibility to do the earth. It certainly says a fair bit, I think, about the working hard of doing good to others and things of that sort. That's what the train of thought I lost, was that nature tells us something about God, etc., and that man has tended to run away from that. I think any gift has a danger of ego tripping with it. And it's not just that. The Bible would probably put it in three categories. I'm thinking the Jeremiah passage. Let not the wise man boast in his wisdom. And that's the sort of area we think of in science and philosophy and that sort of thing. Let not the mighty man boast in his might. And there we go.